session number 28417, Reel 4.
So, John, you said you had in your mind's eye the chiefs walking around a room saying the key to this is the Horn of Africa.
Yes, and you know, the whole of the national effort, both politically, financially, militarily, will be swung with absolute precision to deal with this vision of the future. You know, by the way, it isn't like that at all. I mean, I remember when I first joined the deception organization in the cabinet offices, I was asked to do a paper on some subject I knew absolutely nothing about. I arrived back to my wife and said, what the hell am I going to do? They asked me to do a paper about this, something like the importance of the Falkland Islands or something. And my wife said, don't worry, darling. Look, they're just testing you to see if you've got any ideas. Don't worry. Nothing will happen about this. They'll soon do a proper one. So I wrote the best I could, and I then submitted it. And my boss changed a couple of pronunciation points, and then he passed it on to his boss, and he changed the paragraphing, and then he put it on to the Joint Intelligence Committee, and I arrived back to my wife and said, bloody, you can't do it. It's all right, darling, you know. Went through the Intelligence Committee with, I think I was asked to rewrite one sentence. Went to the Chief of Staff and went to the Cabinet. Now, as far as I know, that is still British policy about whatever it was I'd written about. And it had been written from total lack of any sort of background or knowledge or anything. I don't imagine the system has changed that much.
At that point, did you think that we're looking about 1947-48 now, I suppose we are. Did you think that the Navy might be a career?
Oh, yes, I totally believed. The only thing I ever wanted to be, apart from a lawyer, was the Navy. But I found myself moving into the intelligence side of things, and it was quite obvious that was not a career. I mean, it might be a living.
Why was it not a career?
Well, because you couldn't go higher than commander. And because, again, promotion in the Navy depended almost totally on adequate seagoing experience. And, I mean, for example, after I'd done the cabinet officer's job, I was sent to be rested for 2 years by doing sea time. The first job I was given was the first lieutenant of the Amethyst in the Far East, which was in the Korean War. And that was not really much of a rest. It was quite fun and quite interesting, but you know, it gave me a total cynicism about Indochina and all the subsequent Far East wars, I mean, and the Korean War. The Koreans, you know, we used to go to places where the Koreans were crossing the lines, selling eggs to each other, not an unkind word. We'd be offshore, and with the ministers being there, they'd be killing each other and fighting and a totally phony political thing, but with disastrous results. Then Amethyst fell apart. We literally had a sailor who fell through the deck. So she was shipped home and broken up. And I was then appointed to join St. Austell Bay in the West Indies and the Antarctic. So I had another period in the Falkland Islands and the Antarctic, which I adored. It was great fun. But and it was at a time when the Argentinians were having a go at the Antarctic, so that was quite fun and quite interesting. Then I came back from that, and I was appointed Admiralty again as the officer in charge of the plot, which was the plot of all the Russian ships and border battle, and also responsible for running all the operations that we did to garner intelligence during that time. And at that time, my daughter got polio, and it was when it was apparent she wasn't going to recover, I knew I couldn't go on in the Navy, because I used to be away, you know, for a couple of years at a time. And you couldn't do that. I couldn't leave my wife with that responsibility. So I asked to resign my commission. I had a hell of a job. I eventually only got out by virtually insisting, and I got out on can't remember the right word now, anyway.
You looking for the word compassionate?
Yes.
Compassionate ground.
Yeah. So I left the Navy, and I was then looking for another career. I didn't really expect another career, but I figured I'd had a pretty good career in the Navy. I mean, I'd been decorated, I'd done dangerous jobs, I'd been in odd jobs the whole time, not a typical career at all, but still, I'd had a good go.
What rank were you, Sir John, at this point?
Lieutenant Commander, yeah. At that time, ICI were trying to recruit people who were willing to become work study officers, which is a bloody awful time of motion, you know, Peter Sellers. And it was a bloody awful job, but they couldn't get normal managers to take it on. And it involved, I suppose, viewed by the shop floor, spying on the shop floor and setting values on piecework. And it was a pretty horrid job. But, you know, you could do it with understanding and getting on with people. Anyway, I volunteered with that. I was trained and then appointed as a junior work study officer, which is the lowest form of managerial life. But I always got on well with the people on the shop floor. I never patronized them. I always respected them. I always knew what they could do, and I always knew they knew a bloody sight better than their managers what actually happened. And the experience was invaluable, because, I mean, I used to have to do work study measurements at night. I did a whole system to put incentive schemes on lorry drivers and travel all over the country with lorries and a stopwatch and making notes and producing schemes and staying in lorry drivers' dumps and, you know, eating. And I mean, I soon found that really the world that the managers thought existed didn't exist at all. I mean, the site at Wilton at night had about 1,200 to 2,000 people. No manager on the site at all. And worked like a dream. During the day, we had something like 16,000, and the place was just continuously fucked up. So, it always seemed to me that if I could just simplify things and trust people, I'm going to get on a bloody sight better. I then rose remarkably rapidly through the ranks. I mean, I joined in 57. I became a divisional director,
by 68, it's only 11 years after joining, and during that time I'd done practically everything on the way up. I'd done buying, I'd done selling, I'd done techno-commercial work, I'd done personnel work, I'd managed a large site with about 14,000 people on it.
Can I ask a difficult question? What is it, you must have thought about this, what is it that caused you in 11 years to rise so rapidly?
Oh, I know exactly. I did not believe I could have a career. I always believed there's no way I could get much further. And I always, every time I was pregnant, I'd say to my wife, we better get used to it, darling, this is the last time. I know I could do this job, I might be able to do my boss's job, but there's no way they'll try me on anything else. So, I didn't believe I had a career, and I was not tempted to scheme for it. B, I had always been brought up that you do the best you could for on any task you had. You didn't spare yourself. You worked your bloody balls off, and you took risks. If something was wrong, you bloody said so. So I was continuously saying, you know, we'll never do it if we do it this way, but, or do you realize this is absolutely fucked up? I mean, my very first job I was given was to do a work study on a new incinerator, or the old incinerator. And I spent a day down there, and during the day it was apparent the bloody thing wasn't operating, because the boys didn't know how to soak it or what to put in. I wrote my report in 3 days. I'd worked all the hours I got, so my wife was not there at the time. And I took my report to my boss and I said, here's my report, sir. He said, I'll do you a favor. I won't read this. He said, you don't understand, John. You come from the Navy. We want proper jobs done here. We want thoroughness and application. So I said, yes. So he said, now you go back and do the job properly. I'll see you in a week's time. So I went back. And of course, there was nothing more to find out. So I gave the boys a hand. And we worked out a good way of soaking the bloody machine. When I went back to him in a week's time, you couldn't even see the incinerator when I went down originally. It was surrounded by mountains of stuff. Well, having waited a week, I handed him my report, which I'd not altered, I'd changed the dates. I said, oh, and by the way, sir, I'm afraid that we burnt everything and there's no need to build a new incinerator. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, it's in the reports. Unfortunately, the people there didn't know how to soak it, and there's a combination of dross, which if you're putting in, raises the operating temperature, and everything's gone. If there's anything else, or we wanted to burn for anybody else. So, of course, he's absolutely bloody furious. But now, that was a fairly typical. There are many ways I could have been more tactful. But, you know, the job was to get the job done. And I never hesitated to take on anybody, no matter how politically powerful, because I didn't figure I'd got anything to lose.
Because you didn't have a career?
Because I didn't have a career. And my wife and I were not all that greedy. Being given apparently an outstanding Christmas rise, saying to my boss, excuse me, can you tell me is that a good rise or a bad rise? So I said, no, didn't care.
Were you, I wouldn't say unique, but were you unusual in this?
Unusual, yes.
You were?
Yeah. But you see, again, I had unusual circumstances. First of all, I'd been brought up in a very tough, very demanding background. Secondly, I'd worked very largely on my own for many years. And my success or failure depended on me or one or two other people. And thirdly, I got my satisfaction from doing the best I could.
Yes. So in 68 you became a divisional director. Can you explain what that means?
Well, actually I had at that time 12 divisions, and each division had big eyes down. A chairman, two or three deputy chairmen, and a board of 10. And this remained until I became the chairman of the company, when I said, look, there's no bloody possible reason why it takes one to talk to one. You know, everything doesn't have to have the same, whether they're running a factory or whether they're running an enormous worldwide business. And we actually managed to introduce some change. But at that time, you joined and you were a division director, commercial director, or a division technical director, or personnel director, or whatever it was. I joined originally as a commercial director, and then I became personnel director, and then the personnel deputy chairman, and then the chairman. Each of these was a separate job, and each of these was a promotion. And then I was appointed to the main board in 73, where again I started the whole bloody exercise all over again.
Now, there's a huge difference between being appointed to the main board and becoming chairman, is there not?
Not in theory. And hopefully not so much after I had been appointed. I mean, when I joined, you were given no training to be a public company director. And there is an enormous difference. I mean, you have very specific legal and other responsibilities, which in those days it was assumed you would just understand. The ICI board had been dominated years ago by a dominant chairman. And so the whole organization was to prevent the company being hijacked by one person. But equally well, the board never operated properly as a board. The responsibility for running the board, they were the chairman, but he never did. I mean, the board meetings, the division secretary decided whether you could get something put on the meeting or not. The company secretary, not the chairman. Maybe the chairman was checked with the company secretary at some stage, but he didn't play any personal part. He didn't train you. He didn't try and have real discussions. You would get away without saying a fucking thing in the board. And I did an analysis while I was on the main board that the main job of the main board was to allocate the capital, of which we spent vast amounts. I did an analysis which showed that the allocation of the capital for the 10 years I'd been on the board before I became the company chairman was done in exactly the proportion that the capital was spent in when I joined the board. And I argued from that there was no point in having a fucking board. We could have saved all the money. Because, you know, if we didn't do the job we were meant to do, what the bloody hell? And no wonder the company was running down. So my changes were to reduce half the size of the board. I mean, I joined a board of 16, and By the end of my first year as chairman, I had a board of eight, including the chairman. And that was probably one or two too many. And I made sure the eight worked together the whole bloody time.
These are executive board members, of course, because now everything is coloured by...
Yes, but I also totally changed the makeup of the non-execs. And I got a Japanese on as a non-exec, a German, an American. And I totally changed. And before, of being a non-exec on ISO, it was a sort of good conduct medal. Mm. But I made the board work, and I made it to discuss every issue. And on more than one occasion, I wanted to do something, and the board wouldn't go with me, and we didn't do it. Because the power lay with the board, not with me. I could organise all I wanted.
So you're not quite like a prime minister in a cabinet. You don't have as much power.
Well, I don't think the prime minister in the cabinet actually has as much power.
He does
power.
Have the power of appointment and disappointment.
I had that. I gave myself. I asked to be given that appointment, which we never had before. But of course, again, in our world, you made one appointment, you didn't sort of move people to have a reshuffle or retire people to the House of Lords or anything like that.
Did you alter the... I was going to ask about non-exec directors because, of course, the rules have changed so much today. But then you anticipated me by saying that non-execs were almost seen as a sort of superannuation policy for them. Did you manage to change that?
Yes, and totally. I made them work.
And what did you want to see from the non-execs that you then had, that you appointed?
I wanted them to bring a different viewpoint and tell us when we were inbred, which we were. And I well remember two particular occasions where the executive directors were unanimous on something. And I again had a sort of working rule that when the thing was raised with the whole board, all bets were off. You didn't get any marks for standing where you stood or voting where you were for. And we raised these two issues, and I said to the non-execs, you are particularly important in this because we are unanimous that we think we ought to do this. And they absolutely tore into us. They said, you're mad. You're arrogant. You've got no bloody idea what you're doing. And we had about 3 hours of really that sort of honest debate. And at the end of it, I said, right. And now I'm just talking to my executive colleagues. All bets are off. This is the decision on which we go. I want every one of you to say where you now stand. I went around the non-executives first, and they were not unanimous in the position they took. And then round my colleagues, and every one of us had changed our position. Now that's the right use of the non-exec. And incidentally, in those two occasions, events conspired that we could demonstrate very clearly within a year that they'd been right. And I then had again a special board meeting when I said, I'm calling this board meeting because you remember you persuaded us all to change our minds. And I want to say, to thank you all, and B, to say you were proved absolutely right by this and this. Now, you know, those are just how you make things work.
I want to ask you this, if I may. A divisional director in 68, 5 years, a bit more possibly later, appointed to the main board. This was at a desperate time. Looking back, as I do, back into
No, it wasn't a desperate time. It was a happy time. Well,
I thought the 70s were the worst decade.
Well, we weren't going anywhere, which was desperate. But nobody else thought that. We turned in adequate, adequate but unexciting profit. We didn't take any of the basic decisions. We didn't worry that we weren't going anywhere.
Yourself included?
No,
I'm sorry.
Unfortunately not. And now I never cease to complain. Never cease to be the sole vote the other way.
This never. Is the thorn in the backside that you referred to earlier.
Yeah. But we were a very tolerant company. I wasn't rude. But I used to say, I'm terribly sorry, I can't go with this. I believe this. I believe this will prove to be a mistake.
Did you generate, how did you generate those beliefs? Did you acquire around you a private staff in any way? Or how did you do it?
No, well,
how did you take on a big company? Which is really, in a way, what you're doing from the inside.
Well, wasn't all that different, but difficult, because I'd always been for change, and I knew individuals in every division who were for change and reckoned that we had to change faster. And I used to stay in touch with them and would talk to them or meet them or have a drink together. I mean, it was not an official thing. I wasn't a sort of appointment or anything. And I mean, a company that just marks time. You know, people at the bottom always know when things are all right. I mean, I still have friends, I still do, who are on the shop floor in ISI, who I would meet and talk to or have a drink with. And they say, Christ, Johnny, we're in a right bloody mess. And they would know first. Back to the submarine. And, I mean, there were no... And, of course, the only thing which I do take some pride in is that when I became chairman, which I thought most unlikely, in fact, I very foolishly didn't put money on me for not, because you would have got something 8-1 against my being chairman. I said, we are going to change everything and we're going to start at the bloody top. And if this company had not performed, it was making a loss at that time. It's our fault. It's not the company's fault. And really, that was very fortunate, because showing that we would operate with half the number of board members, increased the chances we wouldn't fuck it up, because the fewer you have, the less likely you are. B, increased the chances we deal with the real problems instead of messing people about and the things they ought to get on with. And I both halved the number, but also cut out half the senior positions in the company. So I was one of three deputy chairmen within a year of taking over, myself and no deputy chairman. And the divisions there between a chief executive and one running one whole division, to there was one deputy chairman at divisional level in the whole company. And the business wanted him, and I said when I took over, you will run your business the way you want and we will not tell you how to do it. And this one lot wanted to keep him. And we used to run sort of sharabang trips and feed him buns and that sort of thing. But he was an object of curiosity.
I must take you up on one point. I talked about the 70s and you said, we turned in respectable profits with the exception of yourself, people were just happy to trundle along. That's in brief. And yet, just a moment ago, you've said we were losing money. I know that was later.
That was actually the year that led to my taking over. I wouldn't have got the job if we hadn't been losing money. If the first loss ICI had made since it was set up, and it was a loss in a quarter. And, you know, it was obvious we weren't going to get out of that bloody mess by just going on doing the same. So it gave me a platform to change every bloody thing.
So the company turned to someone who was a little bit of a maverick to get them out
of.
Who did that?
Oh, well, we'd always had a wonderful system, a unique system. The incoming chairman was always appointed by the board members, not by the outgoing chairman. And every member of the board, including the non-execs, had an equal vote.